Welcome to the Federalist Society's Practice Group podcast. The following podcast, hosted by the Federalist Society's Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, was recorded on Wednesday, March 18, 2015, during a live telephone conference call held exclusively for Federalist Society members. Welcome to the Practice Group's telephone conference call and our discussion today of judicial deference to agency action. I'm Dean Reuter, Vice President and Director of Practice Groups at the Federalist Society. Please note that all expressions of opinion are those of the experts on today's call. Also, this call is being recorded for use as a podcast in the future. We've got three experts who are going to be our main presenters. One is going to be essentially an interviewer or moderator of our program. That will be Mr. Adam White. He is a return guest here to Teleform. He's counsel at Boyd & Gray & Associates right here in Washington, D.C. We're very pleased to welcome him back. And with that, Adam, let me turn it over to you.
Thanks, Dean. The subject of today's conversation is the Supreme Court's recent decision in Perez v. Mortgage Bankers. The court decided the case on March 9th, just a couple of weeks ago. The issue before the court, or the issue decided by the court, at first look is rather straightforward. The D.C. Circuit had long, or for about two decades, had a doctrine called the Paralyzed Veterans Case Doctrine, in which an agency could not make a significant change to its previous definitive interpretation of a regulation without going through notice and comment, even if the underlying interpretation itself, the previous definitive interpretation, hadn't gone through notice and comment. The Supreme Court held unanimously that the doctrine was at odds with the text of the Administrative Procedure Act, which exempts interpretive rules from the notice and comment requirements. But as I said, the case ultimately was decided on a pretty straightforward issue unanimously. But reading the opinions, you could tell that there was a lot more at work. Justices Scalia, Thomas, and Alito all wrote separate concurrences, delving into various issues of administrative law. And furthermore, the case was decided on the same day as the case of Department of Transportation versus Association of American Railroads, a non-delegation case that also gave rise to a number of interesting separate opinions from the justices. And so on the subject of the Perez case and notice and comment rulemaking, we've invited two really terrific law professors, Jeffrey Pojanowski of Notre Dame and Christopher Walker of Ohio State, to walk through the issues. Let me briefly introduce them. Jeffrey Pojanowski is a professor of law at Notre Dame. 2 years ago, he was named Distinguished Professor of Law, Distinguished Professor of the Year. Before coming to Notre Dame, he was a clerk to Justice Anthony Kennedy on the Supreme Court and a clerk to then-Judge John Roberts on the U.S. Court of Appeals, and then he practiced with Latham & Watkins in D.C. At Notre Dame, he's published a variety of really interesting scholarship. One in particular, one is of particular relevance to this discussion. It was titled Administrative Change. It appeared in the UCLA Law Review in 2011. It was co-authored with Randy Kosel. The other speaker is Ohio State's Christopher Walker. Chris joined the Ohio State College of Law faculty in 2012. Before that, he clerked with Justice Kennedy on the Supreme Court, Justice Alex Kaczynski on the Ninth Circuit. He served on the civil appellate staff at the Justice Department and practiced at a firm in Washington. He also is an expert on administrative law. Very active in scholarship, and also active in creating the new blog of the Yale Journal on Regulation, which I highly recommend to everybody. And so with that, let me turn the discussion over to Jeff to give a basic introduction of the Perez v. Mortgage Bankers case, just explain what it was about. Jeff?
Great. Thanks, Adam. Can you hear me okay?
Yep.
Okay, so The Perez case, as Adam said, is reasonably straightforward. It was dealing with an interpretation of a regulation that the Department of Labor made about wages and hours. Under the Fair Labor Standards Act, most people who are employees have to, you know, after 40 hours, they have to get overtime, et cetera. There are certain employees who are exempt. And the question was whether home loan originating officers could be exempt from the wage and hour regulations. And there was a 2006 regulation that the Department of Labor promulgated, you know, through notice and comment, which gave examples and made statements about when people are exempt. And the home mortgage industry asked the Secretary of Labor for an interpretation about whether this applied to these loan officers. And the regulation was 2004, and then in 2006 they got an opinion letter from the Secretary of Labor saying your home loan officers are exempt. They don't have to be governed by the wages and hours. So then a couple of years later, a new president, another opinion letter issues saying that actually looking back at that regulation, we think that regulation was wrong, or that interpretation of the regulation was wrong. These loan officers are properly understood as employees and therefore should be given overtime. They'll get back pay, et cetera. The administrative question was this kind of ran up against what the D.C. Circuit has and what Adam mentioned, the paralyzed veterans rule. So you had a regulation which went through notice and comment, and then in 2006, the Department of Labor interprets it in a less formal manner, but publishes an opinion letter saying, we read the regulation to mean X. A couple years later, the agency goes back to the same regulation and says, actually, we read that opinion to mean Y. X was wrong. Now, under the D.C. Circuit's approach, under the paralyzed veterans rule, that second interpretation of the regulation is void. Once you have an authoritative interpretation of a regulation as an agency, if you're going to substantively change it, you have to go through the notice and comment procedure. You don't have to do it for the first time, but you do have to do it for the second time. And the Supreme Court says, I'm sorry, you cannot do that. The APA, the Administrative Procedure Act, lays out the procedures for notice and comment rulemaking. Agencies are not allowed to add to that. The APA explicitly exempts these so-called interpretive rules from notice and comment rulemaking. Substantive legislative rules have to go through notice and comment. Interpretive rules do not. So whatever policy sense this might make for the D.C. Circuit to require it, they're wrong for doing that. The plain text of the Administrative Procedure Act does not allow them to do that. So you have the D.C. Circuit ruling saying this interpretation is void. You have that ruling reversed, saying the agency does not have to go through notice and comment rulemaking before it changes its interpretation. That's the nuts and bolts. Which way do you want to steer the discussion from here now, Adam?
Well, thanks, Jeff. That was great. As Jeff just explained, the case was on its face about administrative procedure, but a lot of the discussion in the separate opinions, discussion in the briefs, and I should disclose I filed an amicus brief in the case, and discussion at oral argument seemed to focus less on that actual issue, namely the notice and comment requirement, and focused more and more attention on the separate issue of what's known as our AUER deference, namely the deference that agencies get in interpreting their own regulations. Chris, would you mind explaining how it was that the case, even though it was about notice and comment, took on so much discussion regarding our deference?
Sure, and I think Justice Alito does a good job of kind of framing this as, the paralyzed veterans doctrine was developed by the D.C. Circuit in response to, I think, three different concerns. And I'd love to talk about the other two later in the call if we have time. But the first two were the question of non-delegation or of broad delegation to federal agencies. The second was the uncertain boundary between legislative interpretive rules. And then the third one, which is the one that Adam's talking about now, is our deference or Seminole Rock deference, which actually instructs courts to defer to an agency's interpretation of its own ambiguous regulations so long as they're not inconsistent. And so that was what was motivating, at least how Justice Alito reads it, and I think it's right. The paralyzed veterans doctrine was like, hey, we have these three big issues in administrative law that we're worried about. And one of them is this idea that agencies give deference to their own rules or to their interpretation of their own rules. And if that's the case, then if they're going to change their interpretation of their own rules, contrary to reliance interests and others, that paralyzed veterans, at least, would require them to go through no settlement rulemaking. Justice Alito, with Auer, would say, if that's not the case, then we're going to have to defer to their changes in these rules and not be able to look at those de novo, not be able to take a look at the interpretation on its own. And so you get, a real short concurrence from Justice Alito, but then Justice Scalia and Justice Thomas both take very different approaches, but they attack the idea of whether our deference should be given anymore. And I'll start with Scalia. So Scalia does, because this, at the end of the day, was a Vermont Yankee, Administrative Procedure Act interpretation case, where the majority very easily found that the Administrative Procedure Act doesn't require the paralyzed veterans doctrine, and so a court can't add it. Justice Scalia takes a step back and says, well, sure, but the problem is the APA balance is already out of whack because of deference doctrines. And he goes to the standard review and talks about under Section 706 how a reviewing court is supposed to interpret statutory provisions. There's no suggestion there that there's any type of deference owed. And so he walks through hints that Chevron perhaps should be overruled as well, but then focuses really on Auer. And this is an argument Justice Scalia has made in a number of separate opinions over the last few years. I think in some ways, taking the lead of John Manning, where he makes kind of two basic arguments for why our deference should be overruled. And the first is that, contrary to the majority's opinion here, the interpretive rules that command deference actually do have the force of law. And he walks through and explains that, sure, they're still interpretive rules, but because courts have to defer to them unless they're plainly inconsistent, that actually forces courts to accept them and apply them, broadly across the whole administrative state. And then the second argument is another classic argument that he's made quite often in his prior writings, is just the process argument that it's odd to be giving deference when the agency drafts the rules, and then also be giving deference when the agency provides interpretation for those rules when they're ambiguous. And the problem there for Justice Scalia is that it creates odd incentives at the rule drafting stage, because at that point, the agency is going to be, may have incentives to draft more broadly, to leave questions open. And why would that be? Because the agency at the rule drafting stage has to go through notice and comment, the extensive procedures. And if they were to leave things ambiguous, they could then fill it in later with just posting a guidance memo on their website that would then also get deference. And so that's his process concern. So his substance concern is they do have the force of law because we have to defer to them. We can't review it de novo. And then the process is that it creates odd incentives to give the writer of the regulation and the interpreter or executor of the regulation that much power.
And if I might jump in, that also intersects
sure.
with there's an interesting intersection with Chevron doctrine, particularly Chevron doctrine after Meade. Now, Chevron doctrine is the doctrine where an agency gets deference for the interpretation of statutes it administers. As the law is developed, agencies are more likely to get that deference when they've engaged in relatively formal when the interpretation comes through relatively formal procedures, like notice and comment rulemaking. And one of the worries about deference to agencies' interpretations of their own regulations is this is it would be a neat way for them to get around some of the problems of Chevron deference. So you go through notice and comment rulemaking. And make none of the hard choices. No one litigates on that. And then you get to do all the challenging stuff through interpretive rules. So Matt Stevenson has written an essay or an article on this, and talks about the pay me now or pay me later principle in administrative law. You either kind of make the hard choices through relatively more formal administrative processes, so you pay me now, or you pay later through the tax of greater scrutiny and judicial review. So traditionally under Chevron, you can pay now by going through process, heavy process, and get deference, or you can pay later. You don't have heavy process, but you get, you know, either you don't get the heavy deference of Chevron. Well, you know, Seminole Rock or our deference allows them to kind of get out of that pay me now or pay me later. You don't pay now because you go through notice and comment, but without making any of the hard choices, and you don't pay later because you get deference to your interpretive rules that fill in the gaps of everything you left empty during notice and comment.
You know, on the pay me now or pay me later principle, I'll just add, since it was a focus of our amicus brief in the case, it's interesting, if you go back and look at the debates surrounding the enactment of the Administrative Procedure Act in 1945, and even dating back into the reports that the executive branch was putting out in the 30s, they were using that sort of term at the time, pay me now or pay me later, or other such terms, basically to say either there'd be public process up front in terms of notice and comment, or there'd be strong judicial review at the other end of the process. So it's interesting to me how that's sort of coming full circle.
Adam, I just want to add, can I add real quick there?
Yeah, of course.
Two summers ago, I did an empirical project where I went out and surveyed 130-something agency rule drafters and asked them about, do they know the different canons, do they know the different deference doctrines, do they use these when they're drafting regulations? And one of the findings that I thought was pretty fascinating is that 4 in 10 rule drafters that were surveyed indicated that they used our deference when they were drafting regulations. And I wish I would have had more time in the survey. It was 195 questions. I couldn't add more questions to figure out how do they use our deference.
Yeah.
But the comments suggested along the lines of, in some ways, provided support for Justice Scalia's idea that they're thinking about this. And there's a decent argument that they're thinking, I'm going to leave this broad because I can come back and fill it in easier. You know, I'll get this our deference. I can come back and fill it in with a guidance memo. And it actually may be affecting on the ground what agency rule drafters are thinking when they're going through the notice and comment process of regs.
Now, in focusing on Justice Scalia, it's interesting because Justice Scalia, if I remember correctly, was the author of the case Auer, right? This
yes.
reaffirmed the notion of this utmost deference to an agency's interpretation of its own regulation. Would one of you mind just sort of tracing out the trajectory of Justice Scalia's change of mind on this? Because I find it pretty interesting.
I'll be happy. I'll do that. So first off, Seminole Rock, which preceded Auer, was pre-APA, is an interpretation of an agency's interpretation of its own kind of price control regulations during World War II. And the court just kind of, made this kind of deference statement without much in the way of kind of precedential support or citation. They just did it. And I reread Auer this morning, and very kind of brief, again, as with Seminole Rock, almost kind of an afterthought. It's actually an interpretation that came down in a brief by the Department of Labor again. And Justice Scalia is kind of like, we have held, yada, 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 that these interpretations are entitled to great deference, cites a couple cases that cite Seminole Rock, and just kind of moves on. Which makes sense. If you look at his opinion, you think, well, this is a guy who really likes Chevron. He thinks he and Chief Justice Roberts had that big showdown at the OK Corral a couple of years about whether you need whether you get Chevron for agencies' interpretations of their own jurisdictions, and Justice Scalia firmly says yes. He opposes the kind of standard-like test to kind of narrow Chevron. He wants, Chevron or de novo, and he wants a clear rule. And he's pretty comfortable with Chevron's domain being pretty broad. So I wasn't, one would not be surprised to see from one perspective Justice Scalia being yes, for the same reasons, a nice clear rule of administrative deference. It's nice and manageable. You have political accountability with the agencies in a way you don't with the courts, et cetera, et cetera. But then he has a change of heart, and I think the first separate writing, I think it was the Talk America case, which I guess is 2011, Talk America versus Michigan Bell Telephone, he writes a separate concurrence saying, I don't have to use our deference here because I think the regulation is pretty clear, and I'm glad I don't because I'm starting to worry about this. And he cites John Manning's article in 1996, and he raises the concern of kind of self-delegation. This is where he justifies his trust in his belief in Chevron while raising his worries about our. He says, look, in Chevron, you have Congress delegating interpretive authority to the executive. There you don't have the problem of self-delegation. You have kind of checks and balances. You have separation of powers. We may have non-delegation doctrine worries that Justice Thomas has, and I think Chris may want to talk about that later. But he's at least comfortable with the agencies getting power delegated to them to another branch. He says it's very different when you have it with an agency interpreting itself. But one of the, I think he cites Montesquieu talking about one of the marks of tyranny is the ability to interpret your own edicts. You collect all the functions of governance into one head of power, and you don't have those separation of powers that you do at least with respect to Chevron in some muted form. So Talk America, he writes a separate concurrence, and then he concurs again in Christopher versus Smith Kline Beecham the next year, reiterating his concerns. And then again he tees it up here. So it seems like the first I see it getting under the bee getting under his bonnet in his 2011, and he's been kind of banging the drum ever since. And it seems like he's got Justice Alito sympathetic to him, and Justice Thomas more than sympathetic to him. I think Justice Thomas seems interested in going even farther with respect to deference. But so and he's been candid. I think he mentioned in Talk America that he blithely assumed an hour that this is unproblematic, and I think he's kind of had a change of heart.
Now, while we're counting noses, I'm interested in your thoughts on this. As you said, the Scalia, Thomas, Roberts, and Alito have, in various opinions, sort of raised questions about the doctrine. And I'm curious, have the other justices weighed in on this yet? The ones I'd have in mind first and foremost would be Justices Breyer and Kagan, who are well-known experts on administrative law. Have they sort of engaged this debate at all? Have they sort of clued which direction they might be leaning?
I re-skimmed the dissent in Christopher versus Smith Kline Beecham. That's where that was again another Department of Labor case where people were possibly raising the idea of challenging our deference. And there, Justice Alito writes the majority opinion, and he says we don't need to consider whether our deference should ever apply, or because here we think this is kind of outside the realm of our. He says when an agency kind of catches the regulated parties by surprise and does a quick about face and catches people off guard, we're not going to apply our deference then. So whether or not our is good or not or should ever apply, this is an exception to it. We don't need to apply our here. And then he kind of, basically applies lightened Skidmore deference. He doesn't go full de novo, but he does Skidmore. And I saw Justice Breyer's dissent. Breyer dissented and wanted to uphold the government's position. But interestingly, he seems to be arguing entirely on the merits. He does not rely on our deference to say, well, look, you'd think your first argument would be like, yes, let's apply our. And let the agency win. Here he basically kind of argues the merits and says the agency has the better of the two arguments. Now, to me, that can mean one of two things, or it can mean a couple things. But the first might be, he doesn't want to show his hand. Secondly, maybe he might impliedly kind of like the move Alito is doing. So Justice Breyer's, famous or notorious, depending on your perspective, in the Chevron context, saying, look, I don't want to have a hard and fast rule about when Chevron applies. There'll be some cases when it makes sense, some it doesn't. We can kind of pick and choose based on certain features of the decision making. I could see him accepting kind of that approach to our deference. There's some circumstances in which it makes sense. There's maybe some where it doesn't, such as cases in which the agency has done an about face and caught a lot of people off guard. And so maybe his decision to not fight that battle with Alito is he thinks it's perfectly fine to make an exception to there, and there may be some cases where our deference makes sense. But I haven't seen him weigh in explicitly on it one way or the other, and I'm not aware of Justice Kagan weighing in one way or the other.
Chris, do you have any thoughts to add on the general state of the debate within the court?
So I want to pick up a little bit where Jeff, left off with Breyer too. It's interesting, there's my home institution's law journal is publishing a piece this next year by a D.C. Circuit clerk where she looks at like 200-hour decisions since Talk America in the course of appeals. And what she finds is that courts, her take on the data is that when courts don't want to apply our deference, they rely on like the historical boundaries of our that are talked about in this case as well, and that they find ways to get around our deference. And I could imagine along the same lines, once this gets fully briefed before the court, Justice Breyer taking more of a Mead approach and trying to rely more on these historical boundaries to say, all right, we should give our deference in like your core main case. But when we get closer to the lines, we'll want to cut back on that. And so it's going to be really important which case they actually use as a vehicle to get this before the court. But you could imagine Breyer doing something along those lines.
Now, although, as I said at the outset, Perez was decided on the same day as the Department of Transportation Amtrak non-delegation case, I don't think they were actually argued the same day. So the fact that the decisions came out on the same day is sort of an interesting or happy coincidence. And I'm just curious, taking a step back, I'd love to hear your general thoughts on sort of the state of intellectual debate about administrative law more generally. Are debates like this about our deference or Seminole Rock deference, are these debates at the margins, or do you think that there's something more fundamental going on?
So if I can jump in, this is Chris. So the Scalia opinion, maybe I read more into Scalia than Jeff does here. I actually see him making a nod towards revisiting Chevron, and that's interesting to me. I mean, he doesn't go so far as inviting the revisitation of Chevron, but a lot of his analysis about the APA and the statutory foundation, and he actually expressed questions about the concerns about Chevron, they're definitely there. And then when you get to Thomas, Thomas, and glad Adam mentioned this, he has two intellectually amazing, and there's some problems with them, but two concurrences that come down the same day, in this case and in the Amtrak private delegation case, where that one's a lot more about non-delegation. But if you read his his concurrence in this case, in the Perez case, you could almost substitute our for Chevron.
Yeah.
That's the entire opinion. And almost all of the arguments that Justice Thomas is making would be similar arguments you'd be making for why Chevron should be overturned. Like, he's not focusing as much on the oddities of, of our deference that Scalia did. It's much more about delegation. I think his answer would be, don't overturn Chevron, just reinvigorate non-delegation, get the boundaries of what it is, executive policy making versus legislative work, and make those boundaries clearer. So I don't think he would actually overrule Chevron, but I think he would use the non-delegation power to do some work there. But it is fascinating if you did like a find and replace in Thomas's opinion and just put in Chevron instead of our Seminole Rock, it reads like a pretty strong commentary on just the deference doctrines more generally.
Yeah, I think that's really, this is Jeff, I think that's really interesting because I agree with Chris with respect to Justice Thomas. He seems much more hostile to deference more generally. He's citing Phil Hamburger talking about that essentially, you're essentially kind of allowing the executive to exercise the judicial power here in a way that's deeply problematic. And I think you could substitute Chevron for our with respect to a lot of stuff. And it's just particularly kind of ironic, since this is the justice who wrote Brand X, which says, we give Chevron deference even when the agency changes its mind on things, which is a very pro-administrative authority case, saying, look, the agency has the power to make the law here. And with respect to Scalia, I see him, seeing him cite the explicit language in the APA saying the court shall give the interpretation of the law is definitely hard to kind of square, much harder to square with Chevron. One way of reading his opinion, there's a phrase or two where he seems at the very least suspicious of giving Chevron deference to interpretive rules, which sounds maybe more like he's willing to kind of back off from his position in Mead, saying, you know, as long as it's the you know, the agency's position, we'll respect it. He seems maybe at least a little bit more skeptical with respect to interpretive rules as opposed to legislative rules. But I have a hard time to think that he's going to back away from Chevron, particularly after the City of Arlington FCC, where he kind of defends his dignity against the Chief Justice Roberts just about a year or two ago.
Dean,
that's
before
right.
we
first again, just to add on, like at the, you know, the near the end of his opinion, you know, he does. I mean, throughout the opinion, Scalia seems to be suggesting that Chevron's in the same boat, and then he makes it really, I think, pretty clear at the end that, you know, at least with Chevron, we have a long history that predated the APA
yes.
of deference to executive.
He can be a faint-hearted originalist
action.
On that.
Yeah, I mean, so I don't think he's quite there. Although you might view this case as the seed, you know, like Talk America was for Auer. I mean, if Scalia really wants to go after Chevron, I think, you know, 5-10 years from now, we'd be pointing to this case as the case where he first planted that seed.
Dean, before you open it up to questions, if I could just add one further thought on Scalia's approach to this. I've always found sort of an interesting tension in his argument. As he's been criticizing Auer deference, his point has been, as was mentioned earlier, that at least with Chevron deference, you have one body, Congress, writing the law, and another body, the agency, interpreting it. So there's a, sort of a check and balance or a separation of powers. With Auer deference, the same entity, the agency, is writing the law and then interpreting it. In that respect, I think his criticism makes sense. But when you step back, that distinction would lend itself to sort of an odd situation where you'd have the courts deferring to agencies and interpreting statutes when the courts are just as well equipped, really, as agencies to interpret statutes. But then you'd have the courts, through interpretation, really getting down into the fine details of agency regulations and reviewing the substance or interpreting regulations much more thoroughly and aggressively than they would interpret statutes. And so I understand from the separation of powers aspect, Chevron might make more sense than Auer deference, but on the other hand, from an expertise standpoint or a judicial judicial expertise or efficient use of judicial resources or what have you, it would seem a bit odd to be in a situation where the courts are letting agencies interpret the statutes, and then the courts are more obsessed with interpreting regulations. And of course, since these two activities are never really distinct, I'm sure that state of affairs would have interesting feedback effect or interesting implications of its own. If the agency knows that it will be interpreting the statutes, but it'll have less power in interpreting the regulation, you could see the agencies changing the way or taking that into account as they're interpreting the statute in the first place. But now I've rambled on for too long. I just wanted to add one last thing. We were talking before about pay me now or pay me later. I recall when I was working on our little amicus brief in the case, going through the 1937 Brownlow Committee report, the President's Committee on Administrative Management, they didn't use pay me now or pay me later as the term. They used the term prenatal and postnatal, which I thought was a little bit more amusing. But in any event, Dean, do you want to open it up to questions?
Yes, absolutely. In a moment, we'll all hear an announcement that will say the floor mode is on. After you hear that announcement, if you have a question, you can indicate so by pushing the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. So once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We don't have any questions at this point in time, Adam. Once again, star button and then the pound button on your telephone. We've got one question pending, then our lines will be wide open. Let's take our first call of the day here.
Hey, Adam and professors whom I don't know. Nice to meet you via phone. I have a question about standing as it relates to this entire problem. If agencies are going to be redefining the meaning of regulations and only doing it in particular cases, that is seriously going to undermine the ability of other folks who weren't perhaps subject to the particular case at before the commissions from having standing to challenge them. I'm wondering if anyone of you have thoughts about that, because it seems deeply problematic to me, and I don't know if the decision discussed that at all, if it was discussed at oral argument.
Who wants to respond?
If we're trying to master the silence of who to respond. I'll take, this is Chris. Standing, I hadn't really focused on standing here. That's an interesting, because I guess your point is that in other cases, you know, that the interpretation might come down through an informal adjudication in another case. And now it's going to bind a party to, you know, the same rule in future actions. I mean, so the pre-enforcement, I mean, obviously if they're actually going to have it applied, they could seek a similar opinion letter and then go through the challenge that way. If it's actually being applied to them, you know, they could challenge it then. But I guess your question more is if it's like a pre-enforcement review, how do you challenge, get your views? I'm not really sure. I don't know if Jeff or Adam have, you know, further thoughts on that. But I think in most cases, you know, if it's actually going to affect you, you know, there are ways or mechanisms within agencies to get, you know, a similar opinion letter to ask for clarification. And definitely you could wait until the agency tries to apply it against you. But
this is Adam. I mean, there are cases in the D.C. Circuit and elsewhere where an agency will promulgate a policy statement and the court will find that it's not judicially reviewable until it actually, the new policy or interpretation is brought to bear on the party that's seeking to bring suit. And so there is, in many respects, the judicial review issues. That said, oftentimes these interpretations are coming up, not sort of out of the blue as abstract interpretations, but they're arising in the context of an actual action that the agency is intent upon taking.
Once again, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. While we're waiting to see if anybody else rings in, let me ask a quick question. That is, the what I would describe as the astounding growth of the administrative state, both in terms of the numbers of people working there and the breadth of it and depth of its power. Does that play any part in the reasoning of any of the dissenters here, any of the folks that are questioning our defense? The fact that agencies seem to have so much more wingspan now.
Oh, and real quick before you answer that, Dean, I think Jeff may be having a problem with his line. I don't know if somebody can check and make sure that his voice is still getting through.
Okay, we'll check on that.
So, having said that, I'm sorry I cut you off, Dean. If you could,
that's okay. I was just asking if the new increase or the continuing increase in agency power plays any role in the skepticism some of the dissenters are expressing about our deference or even Chevron deference.
Yeah, so this is Chris. I mean, I think absolutely. I mean, I think Alito leads with the broad delegation issue. That is Thomas's whole, you know, both of these concurrences from the same day are all about that. Scalia may be a little bit more nuanced around, you know, the process and substance issues of agents getting deference to their own rules. But I think the broad delegation, I mean, that's why I would put the chief, even though the chief probably strategically decides not to write separately and just joins a majority opinion that's pretty watered down anyways on those issues. I mean, it doesn't take a stance on our or anything like that. But the chief, you know, in the city of Arlington, I mean, that dissent reads a lot like that too. So you have at least four justices that are really, really concerned with broad delegation and trying to figure out how to cut back on it. Seems like Thomas's preferred approach is to reinvigorate non-delegation. Sasha Volek had a great blog post where, with respect to the Amtrak private delegation case that was handed down the same day, saying that Justice Thomas finally gave his answer to Whitman, where Whitman basically got rid of the non-delegation doctrine, or at least took any tooth from it. And so I think Justice Thomas' approach is let's look at non-delegation. Justice Scalia's approach seems to be let's tinker with the deference doctrines, get rid of ones we don't like. And then it's not entirely clear which way, you know, Alito and the chief would go. But I think a lot of it is, you know, to borrow from, you know, is the idea of, you know, the rise and rise of the modern administrative state that's driving a lot of this.
Wasn't that the name of an article by Gary Lawson, I think?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
Dean, I guess your question calls to mind the quote from John Maynard Keynes, I think, that when the facts change, I change my mind. I think in that respect, again, it's been very interesting to watch Justice Scalia, somebody who really has thought through it.
You are approaching the maximum length for a recording.
who really has
reporting after the tone.
Sorry, I'm hearing something in my ear. I was just saying that Justice Scalia is somebody who's thought through the ins and outs of administrative law for so long, not just in his time on the Supreme Court, but his time before that on the D.C. Circuit and as an academic and at the American Enterprise Institute and in government.
You have reached the maximum length.
It's interesting to hear his thoughts changing in light of recent experience.
Yeah, this is Chris. I completely agree with Adam. You know, the other, you know, interesting, I think it was John McGinnis, someone on the blog, suggested that maybe Congress should provide a legislative fix to our, and I thought that might be worth talking about. I mean, I know that this Republican Congress is trying to find ways, it seems, to claw back on the power of the modern administrative state. And, you know, there's a decent question of can they even, you know, legislate deference doctrines. And, you know, there's a great article by Kent Barnett that's coming out at NYU in a couple weeks where he looks at in Dodd-Frank with respect to OCC preemption decisions, that Congress actually legislates Skidmore deference instead of Chevron deference. And I think that's the first instance, at least that's the only one I've heard of, where Congress has gone in and said, apply a lesser deference standard here. Now you could imagine them, you know, the our fix would be even easier. You know, it would just be amending the Administrative Procedure Act and saying no more our deference or our deference only in these situations. I'm not entirely sure how the court would react to that. And I think it would come down to whether the court considers it an interpretive tool like a canon, which they would probably say Congress couldn't tinker with, or whether they would say that it's a precedent that Congress could overrule or change. I think that's a fascinating. It'll be interesting to see how the Republicans in Congress may respond to this decision and the call to revisit our.
Yeah, and I'm back. I had problems with my phone. You guys hear me?
We can hear you.
Yeah.
Okay, great. So, yeah, I think at least to the extent that these deference doctrines have been built on at least the fiction of congressional intent, you know, Congress wants to delegate matters to the agency, it would seem entirely plausible to say, well, Congress can dial that back, right? They can speak clearly and say, we don't want you to defer on this. I could see separation of powers making it harder the other way. I can, you know, if you do think kind of self-delegation or, you know, delegating authority to an agency to interpret its own regulations creates problems, I think Congress requiring that could be more problematic. Oh, and to skip a couple questions back, with respect to standing, this is when I was still blocked out. I think a lot of the way these things come to review, and Adam would probably know this better than me, is someone issues an interpretive letter or an informal thing that doesn't apply to anyone, that doesn't apply to you directly. What you usually do is challenge it as an invalidly promulgated legislative rule. You're saying this interpretive rule in fact is a substantive rule that should have gone through notice and comment, and that way you can kind of get the review. That's one way to get these things reviewed often, and it's through the pre-enforcement area. But sorry to take us back on that.
No worries. Once again, for our audience, let me just remind folks, if you have a question, push the star button and then the pound button on your telephone. Our lines are wide open at this point. Push the star button and then the pound button if you have a question for any of our experts.
On the legislative involvement question, you know, to put my legal realist hat on for a second, I wonder sometimes in hearing about proposals to proposals in Congress to take away deference or to mandate deference, I wonder, wouldn't Congress just effectively be pushing on a string? I mean, what is, I guess my practical question is, what's stopping a court from deferring to an agency interpretation, even sort of sub silentio, when it wants to defer, you know, when it finds the agency's argument credible? And by the same token, what's stopping an agency from refusing to defer, even when deference is nominally mandated by a statute?
Yeah, I mean, I guess this is Jeff Pojanowski again. I think a lot of it depends on how strong your step one is, right? You know, Justice Scalia believes in a very wide zone for Chevron, but he also has a very, very strong step one. And if you think you work really hard and you're pretty confident you've got the right answer, even if it's a really hard question, you could resolve a lot of things you could get around a lot of deference by saying that. If they mandate deference, you can say, well, this is reasonably clear, so I don't have to identify. I don't have to defer. They're clearly wrong, or they're clearly right because this is the best reading of the statute. I think it would just be hard to do. The real test cases where the agency has a pretty implausible interpretation, or the statute is really amenable to only one pretty straightforward reading, and then the courts are really going to have to kind of bend in a way that would be, hard to say that they're following what Congress wanted.
I guess this is Chris. I want to jump in here too, because I think sometimes the legal realist argument, we're looking at the wrong unit of analysis. I mean, sure, courts, and there's Bill Esker, Connor Ass have done some great work showing that deference doctrines arguably don't make a difference in court, but they do at the administrative agency level. That's something that in my empirical study of these rule drafters, they know these deference doctrines. And in fact, at least on the population I looked at, the sample I had, they were more likely to be more aggressive in their interpretation efforts if they knew Chevron applied as opposed to Skidmore. So I think there are some decent arguments that if Congress is sending a message, as they did in Dodd-Frank to the OCC, saying your preemption decisions don't get Skidmore deference anymore, that it's going to change the behavior of the agency. Now, it'd be great if it also changed the behavior of the court, but I think you got to look at both of those. If it does change the behavior of the agency and makes them be more conservative or more, careful before they overreach, then that could do a lot of good. I mean, I see this as an area of our that could send a huge message if Congress decides to try to get rid of our deference and send a huge message to agencies, even if courts don't pay too much attention to it.
And frankly, this is Jeff again. Frankly, if the agencies are probably the most careful consumer of what the courts are doing, and so if they take deference doctrines really seriously, maybe they know more than skeptical legal academics and their parsing of coded cases about whether these doctrines actually matter. Either that or the agencies are irrational and don't understand what's going on. But we should maybe be hesitant to, before we conclude the agencies don't know what's going on with respect to the tribunals that supervise them.
Well, Dean, unless we have any further audience questions,
we do have one question pending.
Oh, great. Okay.
All right, let's take a final question.
Hi, good afternoon to all the panelists. I just wanted to ask a question related to this point about changing facts. You all made the point about the facts on the ground changing because the administrative state is getting larger. I was wondering what your thoughts are on the extent to which Justice Scalia's thinking might be shifting in response to changing legal arguments, and that the argument embraced by Justice Thomas in his concurrence, as one of you mentioned, borrows a lot from Philip Hamburger's work, which does kind of shift the focus to what the role of the judges is and whether they even have authority to defer, which is pretty new in administrative law scholarship. And so I wondered whether the idea of Justice Scalia changing his mind on Chevron isn't as far-fetched, given that he's now being confronted with an argument that he really didn't have to wrestle with in the 90s as much, or really even in the early part of the last decade, but has now been embraced by his originalist colleague on the court. I'm just curious to know what your thoughts are on that.
Jeff or Chris?
I'll jump in. This is a great question. So Scalia is definitely, he's not, as you know, he's not challenging, he's not channeling Hamburger here. But Thomas is, and Thomas is also, rereading the opinion this morning, I was surprised with how much he was speaking to Scalia in his concurrence, how much he was quoting and citing Justice Scalia's prior concurrences and dissents, and really trying to speak to Justice Scalia to kind of nudge him further along. I mean, Justice Scalia's opinion to me reads a lot like John Duffy's article from 15 years ago about how APA 706 means de novo review, or, you know, Chevron's not necessarily built into that. Like, so I think Scalia is, you know, I don't think he is being led by scholars or quite frankly, even influenced by scholars. I think this is really more his experience with our has really soured him and the rise of administrative state and how the doctrine has developed in deference doctrines generally has really, you know, soured him. But it's interesting to see how I think Justice Thomas really is trying to speak to Justice Scalia, and is obviously clearly speaking to the rest of the court as well, but just the number of citations and quotations to Scalia opinion that are woven in throughout both of those concurrences in this case and in the Amtrak case suggests that there might be something going on there.
Jeff, do you have anything further?
Yeah, I think I largely agree with Chris. I think Justice Scalia is kind of two minds. There's a great little concurrence he has. This is a non-admin case, the Jim Beam distiller whiskey case, where it's whether they should do prospective overruling or retrospective overruling only. And he writes a separate little concurrence saying, we should only do things retrospectively because that's what courts do, a very traditionalist understanding of what a court is. And he says, that goes back to the declaratory theory of law, which none of us believe anymore. We're all kind of the winking, we're all legal realists. We're not finding the law, we're making the law. The old traditional understanding of adjudication, that didn't survive the 1930s, yet we only do retrospective adjudication. I think he's kind of torn between being a traditionalist of the hamburger inn sort and being the legal realist as an admin law scholar. I think Chevron, and I think that kind of reflects in his jurisprudence here. I'm not sure he's entirely going to give up Chevron and go full hamburger here. But it is interesting how Thomas is trying to talk with him about that. And this is correlation and not causation, but Notre Dame did have Justice Thomas here last year teach a seminar at which Phil Hamburger was a participant. But I will treat that as correlation, not causation. I do think it's really interesting to see Thomas bring these things in and having people respond to them. And as an academic, it's neat to see ideas mattering and people having to take these things into account and taking these things seriously.
Yeah, the mention of go ahead.
I'd add real quickly though, you know, maybe I'm reading too much into the Justice Scalia quoting himself and Mead at the end where he says that statutory ambiguities were left to reasonable resolution by the executive long before the APA. I think in some ways he's kind of slamming the door shut on the hamburger theory. Thomas is trying hard. I think Justice Scalia is probably more in the Adrian Vermeule camp of like, no, that's not true. Like, administrative law is not unlawful. Historical analysis, I'm not buying. And maybe that was a nod at the end of his concurrence to say, you know, I'm not willing to go down the Justice Thomas route. And, you know, maybe if you were at Notre Dame, he would be. But, you know, I'm not going to go down that route. My view of the history that looks a lot more like Jerry Mashaw's view of the history and a lot less like Philip Hamburger's.
Yeah.
On Scalia, I just add on Scalia and the arguments he's faced. It's interesting if you go back to the article he wrote in the late 80s, just a few years after Chevron was decided. He wrote a piece on judicial deference to executive interpretations in the Duke Law Journal, and he did concede that there's tension between judicial deference and, you know, Marshall's famous line in Marbury versus Madison that it's the duty or power of the judge to say what the law is. And he sort of bristled a little bit at what he called the stubborn refusal of lawyers to accept that maybe courts aren't the only ones who should say what the law is. And so as we were discussing that, I brought up the article because I thought his closing words in that article are maybe a little bit telling. He said, and again, this is just a few years after Chevron was decided, he said, I tend to think that in the long run, Chevron will endure and be given its full scope, not so much because it represents a rule that is easier to follow and thus easier to predict, but because it more accurately reflects the reality of government and thus more adequately serves its needs. And so maybe for Scalia, the change isn't just what's happening on the ground in terms of the facts and not just the types of arguments he's facing on the court, but maybe it's also the passage of time where he's no longer just 10 years out of government service. He's now several decades out and has been on the court long enough now that he either has a deeper appreciation of the work of judges, or maybe a decreased attachment to the work of the executive branch. But that's my two cents. Dean, do we have any more questions?
We have no questions at this point.
All right. Well, with that, I'd love to give our two speakers a chance to offer any closing thoughts and then turn it back over to you, Dean. Jeff or Chris?
I feel like I've said my piece.
Okay. Chris?
Yeah, I'm guessing we'll probably have another one of these in a couple of years, because I think there's a really high likelihood that ours is going to be reconsidered by the court. So I think you got your four votes there at least.
Well, Dean, you can schedule the next teleforum in advance then.
We will look forward to that. I want to thank, on behalf of the Federal Society, our three experts and Adam White, especially for moderating, and the audience. A reminder to check our website for the next teleforum conference call. But until that next call, we are adjourned. Thank you very much, everyone. Thank you for listening. We hope you enjoyed this Practice Group podcast. For materials related to this podcast and other Federalist Society multimedia, please visit the Federalist Society's website at federalistsociety.org/multimedia.